This is CliffCentral.com.
Please note that the views expressed and the advice provided in this show are for general advice and entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated should be treated as a substitute for your own independent legal advice based on your own specific facts and objectives. Therefore, the presenter and CliffCentral.com accept no liability of any nature whatsoever, either expressed or implied.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
Sanbonani, I'm Gary Hertzberg, and this is The Laws of Life on CliffCentral.com. Alongside me today, Lionel Makokotlela and Duncan Mabaso. Welcome.
Dumela, Gary. Dumela,
wait, Duncan. Wait, Lionel. Hi, Gary. Lionel always beats me to it, but I wanted to say hi first. Hi.
Hi to you all.
Oh, my word, Duncan. You know we love you. You're the special one.
We're going to torture him today. Today's show is about torture. It's about torture in our prisons, from the dark days of apartheid to whether brutality and torture in our prisons is still alive today. And the proverb, the more things change, the more they stay the same, is very apt here today. Yeah, you'll hear all about it, Lionel. Our first guest is the fearless Dr. Wendy Orr, who in the 1980s became the first and only doctor in government employment to reveal police torture and abuse of political detainees, and actually went to court on it. Welcome to you, Wendy.
Hi, thanks, Gary, and hello to the listeners.
Good. Also with us is the intrepid attorney, Egan Oswald, who was voted as Human Rights Lawyer of the Year. He's the first South African lawyer who recently prosecuted South Africa with human rights violations and torture at the United Nations, and you won it.
Yes, that's correct. Hello, Gary, and hello, listeners.
Yeah, welcome. You've also acted for 231 prisoners from St. Albans in PE who alleged torture by members of the correctional services. We're going to take you through that case as well. Not a happy ending, but you'll explain it to us.
Good, yes.
Both incidents with Wendy and yourself happened in Port Elizabeth. So for our PE listeners, this one's for?
For them.
For you, yeah.
And I must say, I'm sitting in the company of greatness today, and there's so much energy in here that I think the world is going to heal from.
Yeah, Lionel's getting deep, but it's true.
Oh, my word.
Adding further value to our esteemed guest today is a lady by the name of Melissa Doman.
Hi, Melissa. Gary, thanks for having me.
Now, as a young woman 10 years ago, and you look 20 now, you must be 10 then, whilst doing your honours in journalism, you interviewed and wrote a very powerful little portion which I read. It was all a beautiful portrayal of Dr. Wendy Orr. You remember interviewing her. When I called you and I said, she's going to be in studio, you said, Gary, I want to be there. I want to meet her again.
I did. I think it was a powerful piece. Strangely, it was my first profile piece that I'd ever written. Yeah. And I think that experience sort of shaped writing thereafter. I mean, every time you sort of encounter somebody who's accomplished something so phenomenal or made a difference to the lives of others, I think it sort of resonates with you so that everything you do sort of carries that same sentiment.
Absolutely. So true. Okay, later in the show, towards the end, we'll be talking to guys that are actually going to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. They'll be in studio with us a little later. We'll tell you more about that then. If you'd like to interact with our guests, Wendy Orr and Egan Oswald and Melissa Line, you want to give out some details?
Oh, yes. You can actually touch base with us on our line. It's 0861-555-189. 0861-555-189. Or you can follow us at Hetzlaw. At Hetzlaw.
Hertzlaw. You like it when I say that.
Oh,
Lionel's
yes.
Lionel's poking his spell it. Hertzlaw.
You the lawyer.
Okay, Lions, let's talk to Dr. Wendy Orr. It's a part of our history that we shy away from. Not many of us want to remember it. A lot of us are too young to remember it. And let me take you back a little. Dr. Wendy Orr qualified as a medical doctor at UCT, and 2 years later, she was working at the district surgeon's office in Port Elizabeth. You remember those times in the mid-80s, I think it was.
Yes, I started working there in 1985.
What age were you when you started?
I was 24 years old.
So a young lass who was kind of wet behind the ears, but you knew from varsity days what was going on in our country. You saw as a doctor terrible evidence of police torture and abuse of political detainees.
Yes, in July of 1985, a state of emergency was declared, and that gave police the power to detain anyone who they thought was a threat to the safety and security of the state. So they didn't have to have any evidence. They could simply, you know, kind of look at you and say, oh, you look threatening, and then detain someone. And under state of emergency regulations, the period of detention was 14 days, but that could be renewed and rolled over again and again.
So they kept them there without rights to bail or rights to a fair trial or anything. They were just detained.
They were detained. There was no charge. They were not allowed to see family. They didn't have access to lawyers. The only doctors who they saw were the government employees, like me. So essentially they were kept behind a veil, well, a wall of darkness and silence.
The security police picked up whoever they thought they wanted to. Didn't matter. It was in their sole discretion. They owed no one an explanation, not the family, not anyone. Were the family aware where their loved ones were being kept when they were picked up?
Some were. There were kind of different groups of detention. There was the type of detention where the police would literally go into townships with buses and just pick up any man who was on the street, and they would be whisked away. And, you know, I can imagine a wife coming home that evening, her husband's gone, you know, a mother's son has gone, and they would have no idea where they were. I think often the assumption was that people had been detained, but, you know, the police certainly didn't inform families. There were other people who were activists, the UDF activists, the trade unionists, who'd be picked up at their home very often when their family were there. So then, you know, the wife, mother, partner would know that their loved one had been detained.
So, Wendy, you worked as a doctor in the district surgeon's office. That's the government's doctor, am I right about that? So if somebody's arrested for drunk driving, for instance, he's taken there, and that's where his blood is, in those days, was extracted, and it was done in your office, am I right?
Yes. Well, yeah. We sometimes did it at police stations and sometimes in our office. But so we essentially provided support to the police in the kind of medico-legal work that they needed, and then support to the prisons in terms of providing healthcare to prisoners and detainees.
You also performed autopsies.
Yes, that was part of the medico-legal work we did for the police.
So now all the prisoners that had been murdered or died in detention or whatever, you performed the autopsy, you saw some horrific things. And that's where the red light started flashing, am I right? Or what did you see?
I personally didn't do autopsies on any people who had died in detention, but for me the red light started flashing after the massacre in Langa Township outside Uitenhage, because the victims of that shooting, and I have to say it is eerily reminiscent of Marikana. When I heard the Marikana story, I immediately thought Langa, Uitenhage. The victims of that shooting were brought to the Port Elizabeth mortuary because Uitenhage was too small.
How many people died there?
It was over 20. I think it was about 24.
And injured? 100?
No, the group wasn't that large. Probably about another 30 were injured.
Okay, so you saw all this, these atrocities. Something obviously didn't ring right with you. Did you speak to any of your doctor colleagues about this? Or was it something that you just didn't do in those days?
No. After about 4 weeks of working with state of emergency detainees and seeing, I mean, probably about two-thirds of them had been tortured, abused, beaten in some way, I went to my boss, who was Dr. Ivor Lang, whose name might ring a bell.
It does,
in terms of he was implicated in the death of Steve Biko. So I went to Dr. Lang and I said, you know, I really feel very uncomfortable about the extent of the injuries that I'm seeing. Shouldn't we be doing something to, you know, to address this? And his response was basically, you know, you make sure you document all the injuries, give appropriate treatment, but beyond that, that's where our responsibility ends.
In those days, no one, not you, not anyone, breathed a word about what was going on, lest you should be arrested yourself. That was the way it was.
That was the way it was, and particularly under emergency regulations, because if if I was revealing confidential, you know, top secret information, I could well have been detained myself.
Wendy, you then decided to apply to court, which is a hell of a brave move. I mean, some people must have thought you were crazy then. What was the relief you sought in court? And yeah, I mean, in the apartheid courts, I don't know how they dealt with this, but what happened?
Look, first of all, I have to give credit to the legal profession, because certainly without the human rights lawyer who was supporting me in that move, I probably wouldn't have done, because I didn't know what to do. You know, I didn't know how to access the courts or who to speak to or where to go. But my sister knew Gilbert Marcus, who is a very famous advocate now.
Yeah.
And he was working at the Centre for Applied Legal Studies at WITS with a number of other human rights lawyers. Mm. And he put them in touch with me. So it was in conversation with Helton Cheadle, who was the lawyer who basically drove my case and represented me, that he kind of gave me the option of putting together an affidavit and of going to the court.
So you applied for an interdict?
Yes.
Interdicting the police from doing what?
From assaulting and torturing detainees.
I mean, this is unheard of in those days, that anyone should do this against the police. They were a law unto themselves, especially, as you said, under emergency regulations. Yeah. The matter went before which judge?
Judge Exton.
What was his reputation at the time?
I have to say, when I look back at it, I think I approached it in a relatively naive way.
You were 24 years old.
Yes.
Right?
You know, I had a very strong sense of right and wrong and of justice and injustice. And that's really what drove me. It wasn't political. It was a sense that as a doctor, I was incredibly privileged to have people's lives in my hands. But with that privilege came responsibilities. And one of the responsibilities was to protect those people.
Yeah, well, you served with a number of other doctors, none of which did anything. So everyone looked away and said, well, it's not my problem, which is what was happening in this country at the time.
Yeah.
You were the only one that had the balls, if I can use that.
Although I didn't.
To bring the application, were you successful?
We were. We were granted the interdict the next day. I can still remember it was a Tuesday afternoon. We filed papers. Mm. It was urgent, so the matter was heard on the Wednesday morning, and we were granted the interdict that very day. The police were so surprised. They didn't see this coming, that they didn't even oppose the application in any way. So it was granted unopposed.
So what was the effect of the court order? Did they carry it out? Did they? Well, not really, or did they?
Well, one of the reliefs that we sought in the court order was that it had to be read out to the detainees in North End and St Albans Prison.
Excellent.
So they had to bring all of the detainees together in one of the courtyards, and the head of the prison had to get up and say, in the case of Wendy Orr versus the Minister of Law and Order, and I have to say I still love saying that, it has been found that the police may not assault you when they arrest you. You may not be removed to Louis LaCranchy Square for interrogation and torture, etc., etc. And quite surprisingly, I suppose, it actually did have an effect. People who were in detention before and after the interdict told us how things had changed, that they were treated really quite courteously when they were removed for interrogation. You know, the questions were asked, but there was no torture. And the random assaults that the police had been carrying out also diminished dramatically. And I think that's testimony to how insidious silence can be. Because as long as there was silence, or certainly official silence around this issue, the police thought that they could do what they wanted. But once, you know, the spotlight was cast upon them, they actually did obviously think, whoa, you know, we better watch it, because it's no longer this veil of secrecy that is drawn over us.
What about your colleagues, your family? What did your parents say about this? Did they say you were crazy, or did they support you?
My father was incredibly supportive, and he had brought us up with the kind of sense of justice and injustice. So my mother was supportive, but incredibly anxious for me.
I'm sure.
You know, she just kept saying, "Oh, my child, are you going to be safe?"
Surprised you weren't arrested for some or other.
I think one of the reasons I wasn't arrested was because of the huge publicity. And I think there was a realization that to arrest me would, just attract a huge amount of negative publicity. I was headline news all over the world. I mean, quite literally. Mm. And I think there was a sense that they had to kind of treat me with kid gloves, particularly because I had emphasized that what I was doing as a doctor and as a medical professional. Look, I think also the fact, and I'll be blunt, that the fact that I was a white woman kind of made them think, ooh, you know, maybe we better be careful about how we treat her. So I wasn't detained or arrested, but I did receive.
You went back to your position at the district surgeon's office?
I did, but yeah. I was basically banned from doing any work that could be vaguely, controversial or in which I might have access to information.
They made you clean the offices or something menial. Wendy, you also, I mean, your life is very important to us from a historical point of view. You also served as a commissioner on the TRC.
I did.
Yeah. Tell us about that and what...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I've kind of lived my life in 10-year cycles because that was 1985. And then in 1995, I was trying to get back to living a normal life. The struggle was over. We'd had our elections and I thought I can just go back to being a doctor. And the legislation bringing the TRC into being was passed and I got phoned by Barney Padjana, who was chairperson of the Human Rights Commission, and then by Barbara Masekela, who was president of the ANC Women's League. And both of them said, can we nominate you to be a commissioner on the Truth Commission? And I honestly thought that I was hardly the best qualified person. And so I said, well, sure. But I really never thought that anything would come of it. And then a parliamentary multi-party committee was put together. They went around the country interviewing people. They interviewed me. And, I mean, this is really funny. About 2 weeks after the interview, I came home and I turned on the news. And they said the 17 commissioners who are going to be on the TRC have been announced, and there was my name. That's how I found out.
Okay, so people came before the TRC. Let's just remind everyone listening, these were people that had undergone terrible times in apartheid in some way or another, and they came and told their stories.
Yeah, they were two committees of the TRC that held hearings. One was the Human Rights Violations Committee, and it was to that committee that the victims of human rights abuses came and told their stories. Mm. And then there was the Amnesty Committee, and there that was where perpetrators, on the condition of full disclosure, applied for and were granted amnesty.
Okay, so let's talk about the amnesty for a moment. People that committed horrific acts in those days, if they came forward and gave a full account and a truthful account, they were given immunity from prosecution, really, which we call amnesty.
Yes, there were a couple of other conditions. So the the abuse had to have been committed within the political context of the past. So you couldn't you couldn't just say I killed my neighbor because I didn't like him, give me amnesty kind of thing. It had to be contextualized. We also talked about proportionality. So was the abuse in proportion to the desire? I mean, it sounds terrible when you talk about it in this way. But so, for example, if you wanted to assassinate one person, did you set a bomb that killed 50 people? That would be disproportionate, and it would be unlikely that that person would receive amnesty. So there were a number of conditions. It wasn't automatic. And indeed, we denied a large number of people amnesty because they didn't fulfill all the conditions.
Talk to us about how the TRC came about. After the Second World War, people were actually prosecuted. We talk of Nuremberg, the Nazis were prosecuted. Many of our army people could have been prosecuted and correctional services people. How come they kind of got away with murder by agreeing and confessing? How did that happen?
In the negotiations leading up to the first democratic elections, this issue of, what's going to happen to the perpetrators of human rights abuses, on both sides, quite frankly. I mean, the ANC didn't have an entirely clean record either. But the security forces, so the South African police and the defence force at that time, were insistent on a blanket amnesty. They said one of the conditions of us now allowing these elections to go ahead is anyone who may have perpetrated any kind of abuse must get amnesty. And the ANC said no. And the security forces said, well, actually, we are still in control of the vast majority of the weapons and the arms, and et cetera, et cetera. And if you don't give us amnesty,
I'm going to blow you up. Yeah.
Yeah. The ANC actually walked out of the talks at that time and said we won't negotiate, you know, at the barrel of a gun. And Mandela and Khada Osmal and Ahmed Kathrada, then with some of the representatives from the security forces, then got together to broker this agreement of conditional amnesty, not blanket amnesty, but also balanced by giving the victims of the violations an opportunity to be heard and by providing reparations. So that was the negotiated compromise that they came up with.
One often wonders, did it work? I mean, it's a stupid question because many people will say it didn't work, and others will say, well, it had something.
I think it was hugely ambitious. And was never going to deliver national reconciliation. I think that was an unrealistic expectation. I think it certainly delivered truth, and that a lot of things which had been denied or swept under the carpet or were now undeniable. So certainly from the truth point of view, I think it succeeded. From the reconciliation point of view, I think there were individual examples of reconciliation. So I meet the person who killed my husband, and together we come to some kind of, you know, resolution. I forgive you, we move on. But
today they call it restorative justice, yes, which is used in our courts now. In any kind of case where someone's been hurt or whatever, they get the parties together instead of putting the accused through the system, and they try and find a solution. Apology, money reparation. By the way, was there money reparation to victims in those days?
There was some. We made a number of recommendations to government about the type of reparation that we believe should be delivered. And part of it was monetary. We engaged with economists to come up with you know, a number which we thought was realistic. And it was going to be annual payments of a certain amount over 6 years. But at the end of the day, government only delivered 3 of those payments.
Okay. Just lastly, Wendy, you saw, whilst sitting as commissioner, you call it commissioner, people that came forward and told some very, very teary stories. You told me before the show that there were many times that you, and I know that Bishop Desmond Tutu broke down. You also broke down when you heard it. Tough to sit there, wasn't it?
Yeah. And in fact, the one case where Archbishop Tutu broke down in public was actually a man who I had seen in 1985 after he had been tortured. And it was his story of his torture that actually brought the Archbishop to tears. So, and there were many others. But one thing that struck me was, in fact, the remarkable resilience of the human spirit that came through for me. So people who had suffered the most incredible losses or personal pain were somehow able to overcome it and still had the courage to speak about it in public.
Yeah. There's someone that interviewed you many years ago. She was a young cub. We call them cub reporters, or were you a reporter then, or just a journalist?
I was student. Studying. I was still doing my honours in journalism.
Yeah. And you met Wendy, you interviewed her. Your name is Melissa Doman. Mm-hmm. What age were you then when you met Wendy?
I was 21.
Cool. You were really a chicken, as we say.
That's barely legal.
So when you heard today that Wendy was going to be on our show, you said, Gary, I want to be there.
I did. And I think, as I said earlier, meeting people like Wendy, people who have made, who haven't been afraid to stand out, is what the country needs, what society needs. Mm. Because I believe that in each one of us, we're blessed with certain talents, but it's no good having a talent unless you fulfill its purpose, or you fulfill your purpose using that talent. Yeah. My talent, I produce content. I'm not used to being behind a mic.
No, you're not doing badly.
No, not at all.
Melissa, your article is published. It's on the internet. It's under Melissa Doman, Douman. Mm-hmm. For our listeners, they can pick it up. Have a look at this. It's A4 pages. You say something about Wendy that touched me. You said she's a woman with a cause and a heart of gold.
Yeah.
Okay, without sounding patronizing, I mean, who goes out of their way, puts their life at risk, which she did, trying to get, and got a court order that really probably saved many, many lives. You know, people don't really realize how impactful what Wendy did was on our people at the time.
I don't think Wendy realizes how many lives she's impacted, having done what she's done.
Yeah, we see movies like Schindler's List where people were saved, and then we look at Wendy. She's in our studio today. She's carried on with life. She's successful now, but you know, it's many years ago, but we want to bring it back. We want to remind everyone that there are people like this that save our lives and do great stuff. We have another guest as well who, after the break, we're going to bring in. His story is even as powerful. Have I cut you, or is there something you want to say, Melissa, about Wendy and your?
No, I mean, I know you keep making the referral that I was just a cub when I wrote the story, and obviously, if I had the opportunity to rewrite it, it probably would be a bit more refined. But the lessons that I learned is important for me to share today, and that was 10 years on. Mm. Obviously, I've undergone my own struggles. I faced my own hardships. Yes, it wasn't. It's not something that I obviously want to talk about. But the thing is, when you have encounters like the encounter that I had with Wendy, with people who've made a phenomenal change, it's those encounters that help you get through your hardship. And I think being in PR or being a journalist or being an advocate for change or being able to communicate change means that we're able to make a difference to other people's lives, you know, and help them get through their hardships. So, yes, maybe a problem isn't publicly demonstrated or expressed, but it's those encounters and reading about people's experiences that help us make a difference.
You know,
in our own
these
lives.
Stories, lest we forget, must always be raised. It's part of our history. We need to know about it.
And we have a responsibility.
We gloss here, for sure. Yeah. You were born free, so kind of.
Well, kind of. Yeah. I mean, if you look at me, a lot of people...
Well, you're not quite. No, you're older,
Well, a lot of people look at me and they go, what are you? Yeah. It's not what race are you, it's like, what are you? And I'm like, I'm a human being, I'm a South African national. Yeah. But I find...
I mean, did your family and parents go through tough times?
They did. I mean, I'm mixed race. Mm. My birth certificate calls me other colored. I don't know what that means, but...
other colored.
I'm other colored. Oh, okay. Yes. Yeah, so my mom, in fact, had to be adopted because she was born to... her biological mother was white and her biological father... I'm not sure who he was because he's not on the adoption papers, but he was obviously non-white. Mm. And in that time, it wasn't allowed, you know, to raise a mixed-race child.
To live together.
To live together. But I come from a background where my family is quite diverse, you know, not only in terms of race, but in terms of religion. So Easter time is fantastic because... We've got Jewish people, Muslim people, and Christian people breaking bread at the same table.
We do have a rainbow nation in certain ways. I'm going to say to you, thank you very much for coming in. We've got so much to cover. When we come back, there's a man called Egan Oswald who's done some remarkable stuff. You've got to hear it. We'll be right back.
CliffCentral.com. It's back. Are you Jawsy Tough? Cycle through tunnels, over floating bridges, and into colossal stormwater drains. You're a machine, and nothing's going to stop you. With two separate routes, a 22K for beginners or a 54K for the tougher riders. Go where no mountain biker has gone before. On the 29th of May, ride the Hollard Juma. Brought to you by AdReach and Joburg City Parks and Zoo. Challenge accepted. Juma.co.za.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on CliffCentral.com.
I'm Gary Hertzberg with Duncan Mabaso, firstly.
Hey, Gary. You know, astonishing stories being told today.
It really has.
Very profound. What did I say when we started and you said I was getting deep? This is deep. You can never get deeper than this, Gary.
Yeah, that's
but
for sure.
I must say, thank you so much, Wendy, for sharing these amazing stories with us. It's very empowering for what you did. Yeah, and we need more. South Africa is really did living with possibilities because people like yourselves are making that possibility become possible.
Well, I think she's making more of a difference now. She works for one of our leading banks. We can't say which bank, but she is doing good work for all of us, I think. And we value everything you do for us. She's the fearless Dr. Wendy Orr, who who you've all heard of. Google her. There's so much on Wendy that will keep you going for hours. Let's talk. Sorry, Lange, you want to say something?
Yeah, are you going to write a book?
I have written a book.
What is it called?
It's called From Beaker to Besson.
Wow, interesting. I'd love to read this.
You got free copies for us?
Unfortunately, it was published many, many years ago and is now out of print.
Oh, really? Pity. Mm. Yeah. Okay, let's talk to Mr. Egan Oswald. Egan, welcome to you, sir. You're an attorney like me, so you're a colleague of mine. Marvelous to have you in studio. You're the first South African lawyer to have prosecuted South Africa with human rights violations and torture at the United Nations. This is when? A few years ago?
Yes, yeah. It was finalized in 2010.
Okay, so you funded this yourself, and a man called Bradley McCullum, who was an inmate at St. Albans, consulted you, and he said, we're being tortured. So you decided to take this to the UN, and you did.
Yeah, that is correct.
Tell us about what happened and how it panned out.
Well, basically in 2005, we got reports of sort of widespread torture at St. Albans, and there was a couple of articles in the newspaper describing what had happened. And I started to do a little bit of human rights work, but I didn't really want to get too deeply involved in it at the time. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of focus more on my commercial work. But we kind of sat there and waited to see if somebody else would take some action against it, if the police would go in, if the judicial system would intervene in some manner, and nothing really happened. These people kept on phoning me, and family kept on phoning me, et cetera, et cetera. So a friend of mine as well, who was in prison at the time, advised me that this was going on and that it was real in his opinion and that something needed to be done. So I sort of went in and started to see a couple of people, and it just snowballed. And before long, I had 231 people who wanted to claim reparations for what had happened to them. So we started that process, and we tried to sort of initiate criminal prosecutions and try and see if the internal oversight mechanisms would attend to the matter. But nothing really happened, and it was at that stage that I realized that I was sort of against this conspiracy of silence. So to try and break that, one of the things that we did was go to the United Nations and try and get sort of an outside voice to cast some light on what had happened there.
The government was obviously made a respondent. They knew all about it.
That is correct, yes.
And did they respond?
They were given about 7 opportunities to respond, but they did not.
Okay, let's just talk about the atrocities that I've read here. McCullum is the man who says he was raped by a warder using a baton during the winter of 2005. He was beaten, attacked by dogs, trampled on, given electric shocks. He says the warders beat them with batons, broomsticks, shock boards, pool cues, and pickaxe handles. As a result of the terror and electric shocks, the prisoners urinated and defecated on one another.
Yeah, it's really quite horrific, those allegations. And those allegations are mirrored by almost all of the other 231 people and many other people who chose not to become part of the case or who didn't want to become involved in the matter.
One wouldn't think that in today's society, many years after apartheid, this is still carrying on, this torture. Who would have dreamt? It is. Even possibly worse.
Well, I suppose that is the shocking thing about it. I think, as Wendy said, living in the Rainbow Nation, we thought that we were immune to this type of stuff. But the fact that the matter happens all across the world, in all jurisdictions, it's part of the human condition.
There's a wonderful journalist called Carolyn Raffaele. I think she interviewed you, or she's written about this extensively.
Yes.
I'm a great admirer of her work. She writes that it was a bit of a David and Goliath journey, this. You were fighting the government on behalf of one lone inmate, kind of, and that's what you took to the United Nations.
Yes, I suppose it really is that sort of a battle. That's kind of the nature of these battles.
The United Nations found South Africa guilty.
That's correct, yes.
Do they use that term? Do they say they found guilty, or what do they use?
Not really. They found that South Africa had violated its obligations at international treaty law. Two important treaties, Convention Against Torture and the International Covenant Against Civil and Political Rights. And basically those instruments prohibit torture and cruel and inhumane treatment of detainees.
What were the sanctions that were imposed on South Africa?
Well, a decision came forth, and that decision said that South Africa should properly investigate these allegations and make proper reparations for the people concerned.
Did they?
Also institute disciplinary proceedings against the warders concerned.
Yeah, that's something I want to know. Did they do anything? Are the warders still around or do they discipline them?
No disciplinary proceedings were instituted against the warders. In fact, just before the trial was to commence, those disciplinary proceedings were withdrawn. And so nothing further has happened.
So these warders are still around?
Yes, they are. They're still working. They're still, many of them are still at St. Albans.
This is what pisses me off so often. So many of these people that work within government commit atrocities. Our police, we've heard it many times. And then the minister gets sued. He pays out millions and the people that commit the atrocities are still there.
Well, this is exactly one of the great limitations of court cases, especially the type that we do, in the sense that at the end of the day, reparations sound only in a monetary award that ultimately, if you're successful, is made against the defendant in favour of the plaintiff. But the type of systematic issues that are going on are not remedied, and really the case just becomes a book entry in the Department of Correctional Services or police or whatever department's financial statement. So there is a bigger issue at play, and it's the obligation of our civil society to try and prevent this from occurring and from going on. And you know, I think if we had reacted as a society properly to this incident in 2005, we might not have had some of the other incidents that have flowed thereon.
Okay, aside from the prosecution of South Africa in the United Nations, you also sued civilly on behalf of the 231 individuals who all claim to have been tortured in this very prison, St. Albans.
That is correct, yes.
Now, the case was heard in the Eastern Cape Division, Port Elizabeth, before Judge Chetty.
That is correct, yes.
You sued for money, but the money wasn't mentioned. It's one of those where you fight the merits first and then the money's discussed or settled or decided upon later.
Yes, essentially that's what happens, is that the court will put a figure on it or the parties will come to some sort of a settlement.
Okay, so what really happened in this very case, according to the papers that I've read, is that one of the correctional officers was murdered by an inmate.
That is correct. His name was Nwakula.
Yeah.
And he was part of the family of the then Minister of Safety and Security, Charles Nwakula, and who later on, his wife, Nomsa Mapisa Nwakula, became the Minister of Correctional Services and now is our Minister of Defence.
Oh, okay, very close to home. So what happened was the department decided to bring in the EST, which stands for the
Emergency Support Team.
And this was to quell disturbances in the prison, but I kind of have a feeling it was to teach the buggers a darn good lesson there for murdering one of... Anyway, whatever.
Yes.
So the underlying theme was that the judge says, he says, the underlying theme capitalized upon during the trial, to borrow the iconic phrase from Shakespeare's Hamlet, was that the EST was deployed to revenge his foul and most unnatural murder. That's what the judge says here in his judgment. So the EST came in, and there were allegations, serious allegations made, that these poor prisoners were made to strip naked. They were made to lie on the cement floor with their face in one another's buttocks, kind of in a line. They were kicked on the neck, back, and other parts of their body. Buckets of water were thrown on them during midwinter temperatures. Electrical shocks, dogs were set upon them, and so on. And this is the case that you fought in the Port Elizabeth Court.
Yes, yeah, that is correct.
Egan, how many days did this trial take?
40 days.
Oh, wow.
In court.
Who funded all this?
It's all a self-funding exercise.
I hate asking because no one wants to hear about a loss, but it wasn't successful. And having read this judgment, I can't criticize the judge. I'm trying to work out why.
Yes, well, we're trying to do the same, I suppose, to a certain extent. We've lodged an application for leave to appeal in front of the same judge, and that was dismissed last week. Mm. So we're now drafting an application for leave to appeal to the appellate division. I believe at the end of the day that another judge looking at the matter will come to a different decision.
It's a question of fact, isn't it? I think what the judge found, that on the facts, there was no torture or that your clients were lying, something like that. Yeah. I think he calls one of them an unmitigated liar. Maybe wrong.
Yes, yeah. No, he does do that, and he uses some quite colourful language to describe them. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, the issue really, to a large extent, is the credibility of the witnesses and the mechanisms that we use to evaluate the credibility of the witnesses, and that's part of our line of attack at the end of the day.
You're probably, or not probably, you may land up in the Constitutional Court one day, who knows, if there's a constitutional aspect to it.
I think so. I think it's always going to be one of those cases that is going to land up in the Constitutional Court. If you look at other jurisdictions, most of these cases aren't finalised in the court of the first instance. Most people lose. So it's just part of the nature of the beast.
It's very sad that these people, I mean, is it suggested that they're all lying, all 231 made up this story about having to lie on the ground, have, you know, with your head in another guy's buttocks? I mean, is that...
Is
it all made up? Or?
It's difficult for me to comment on that.
We're kind of before the courts. And
My motivation for the case, much like Wendy Orr, is a sense of justice, a sense of right and wrong. I think what happened in Albany was wrong. Yeah. I think that we need to fight the matter to the bitter end, and we need to give the legal system the proper opportunity to make sure that justice reigns.
Yeah, you've got counsel that are behind you. Is it the same advocates that have applied for leave to appeal?
Yes, yeah, we've got the same team. Mm. We've had to pare down the size of our team, obviously, because of costs, et cetera, but we are, yes, counsel have stuck by me. Advocate Bruce Dyke.
Good. Nice to mention him. Is he a Port Elizabeth advocate?
Yes. Yeah, he's a very senior advocate in Port Elizabeth and does a lot of human rights work and has really been a great assistance to us.
There's some good people out there. Hey? They really are. People that take on these cases.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, yeah. You know.
And you. What awards have you won?
I've won a couple. I got an award from the Cape Law Society as the Human Rights Lawyer of the Year. And there have
fantastic.
Been a couple.
Great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Do you make a living? Are you making a living doing all this? It's hard, isn't it?
Yeah.
Money's not everything, is it? You still got to pay the bond and the groceries.
Certainly not. I'm fond to say that I'm married well. My wife does good work economically, and that keeps
does
us
she work
going.
In a bank?
And not quite that lucky.
Well done, Egan. I mean, you may not have won this. One day we'll bring you back. Hopefully the result is different.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it is a release of the state's liability here. The court has found that there was no torture, so we've got to be very clear on that. And that although I've mentioned all these allegations, they were only allegations and they were found to be incorrect, not true.
Well, that's in the court of the first instance, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Let's bring on someone, two guys. Come forward, guys. We've got Sibo Siso, and we've got a gentleman called Mr. Mabaso, another Mabaso. Come
in forth. The studio.
Yeah.
With Duncan Mabaso.
Come through. You're also going to speak, Sibo. Both of you are going to talk. So this is quite an interesting one. We've got Sibo Siso Kanya from a company called Seacom. It's a company that's funded six of their staff members to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. Why am I raising this today? Well, it's a great cause that you guys are doing, and if we can raise awareness and help you raise funds, then we've done something. Okay, so let's talk firstly to Richard Mabaso. You from the Imbumba Foundation?
Yes.
Nothing to do with torture?
No.
To me, climbing a mountain is torture. But that's just personal.
Well, it is, I think, in a way. But learning or having learned mountain climbing from Sibo Siso Vilane, the first black African to summit Mount Everest twice, you know, he always say that we must always remember that the mountain does not grow, but you as a person has the ability to grow above the mountain.
Yeah, so, lovely.
Yeah, so that's why instead of seeing it as torture, we see it as a challenge.
Okay, so Sibo, we call you Sibo, Sibo Siso Kanya. You're a Comrades Marathon runner. You've done how many?
Five. I'll be doing the sixth one this year.
Yeah, it's now.
Actually, coming Sunday. This coming Sunday.
Good luck to you. Hey? Yeah. You're going to improve your time, I hope.
I hope so. And I'll
what time are you doing at the moment? You can take off a few minutes. We don't mind. What's your time?
I'm hoping for the sub 10 this time around.
Cool. Now, you're going to climb Mount Kili. You've never climbed before.
Nope.
Who's paying for this?
We're fortunate enough to be nominated in from our company, from the company that I work for,
Seacom. Yeah, a very prosperous company, aren't they? I don't mind if they spend a little money on their staff. No, in any case, it's very nice. But it's not just the climb that's important. You're raising funds. Who's going to talk to us for girls, for sanitary stuff, sanitary towels, of all things?
Okay.
And you know what I read? I mean, it is really something that guys don't even think about.
Yeah.
More than 2 million girls do not have access to adequate sanitary protection.
Yes. Yeah. Well, this started for me as in 2011, and I remember exactly it was in December. I was home for Christmas, and I love saying this because, you know, whenever I do presentation, going back to our Rainbow Nation and where we make fun of each other, some of my white friends would say, but what's wrong with you black people? On Christmas, you go home, and we on Christmas go on holiday. So, you know, I always remember that.
Yeah.
So I was home.
I go on holiday to your home.
So, yeah, I was home for Christmas in December 2011. And, you know, just out of the blue, just lying outside under the tree, I overheard a conversation between my mom and my niece. My niece was basically telling my mom that she's having some pains. And, you know, she tried to explain, but my mom now had an idea of what was happening in her body. She said, no, don't worry about this. You are a girl. This was going to happen to you. So don't, you know, talk about it. And then at the end of the conversation, she was like, you can't talk about this in front of your uncle. What are you thinking? You know, you're not allowed to do that. So it was that conversation in 2011 that inspired me to say, one, I just want to be more aware on the menstrual issues. I want to find out, you know, so what if that girl doesn't have access to sanitary protection, but also she does not have, or maybe she comes from a child-headed family where there's no granny or mother who can afford. So I said, if we as men don't play a role or take part in this initiative to bring the awareness, but also to go to a shop and buy a packet of sanitary pads. And mind you, by that time, I had never ever, let alone, you know, trying to buy a pack of sanitary pads, I had never ever, you know, I tried by all means to avoid walking through that aisle. So I had never done that. So I said, if we don't do that, we are risking our beautiful young sisters and we are risking their lives, because some of them start falling into traps like, you know, falling in love with the sugar daddies because they want them to provide some of the basic necessities.
Very basics. 50 days of school annually are missed by girls who don't have, because they don't have sanitary protection pads and that, and they stay at home.
Yes.
Those are the stats that I have here. It says it's estimated an average poor girl in South Africa may miss up to 50 days of school annually due to menstrual-related challenges.
Yes, so
that's just short of 2 months that she's missing a year. So absolutely. What you're trying to do, guys, I'm going to give you a few more minutes because I want to end off with Wendy. Mm-hmm. What you're trying to do is you're raising money. How do we help?
Okay. Seacom will also speak on that, but also We challenging South Africans, private sector, public sector, individuals, organizations, churches, to either donate to our cause.
How do we donate? Do we SMS or how are you doing it?
There is an SMS. It's very simple. You SMS the keyword girl child to 42513, and you will be pledging 30 rand per SMS.
Okay, we're going to tweet that out.
Yes.
We'll all tweet it.
Yes,
that would be great. And we'll try and get the message out.
That would be excellent.
Those 30 rands are going towards this cause.
Yes, they're going towards the cause.
And what's the climb? How does the climb get involved? Whatever, if you get to the top, what happens? Do you get more money?
Yes, we like I was saying earlier, we challenge churches, you know, organizations, individuals to rally behind the cause. You can go to your local school, your local shop, your local whatever to start collecting sanitary pads. We can talk to people that are willing to get, we've got like really nicely branded collection bins that we can give people to take to their churches, to their shops, anyway, to collect the sanitary pads. But also people may feel free to to donate directly.
Okay. Website, please, Richard. Where do we go on that one?
It's very simple. It's www.imbumbafoundation, spelled imbumba.org.
Okay. I've asked Lionel and Duncan whether they want to go mountain climbing, and this is kind of what their answer is. Yeah, there's no mountain high enough for Duncan and Lionel. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Gary.
I can't see you climbing a mountain, can I? Can you really?
Yeah, I'm an outdoor kind of guy.
You can't climb a molehill, Lionel. Come on, man. Maybe Duncan would. Okay, guys, thank you very much for being here. Sibusiso Kanya, I call you Sbu. And Richard Mabaso. Are you related to Duncan Mabaso? No.
Well, in our culture, yes. We are always related, regardless of how far or where, you know, in the world you come from. If we have the same surname, we believe that we were once together somewhere, somehow.
Cool. Imbumba.co.za.
No, Imbumba Foundation. Foundation.org.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah.
Okay. Good.
No problem.
Great. And then the SMS we've got, and we'll tweet it out for you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you,
Dr. Wendy Orr. How many awards have you won, Wendy, before we let you go?
I have to admit, I don't remember. But so it's probably the one that stands out in my mind is the one that I won in 1985, which the Star newspaper at that time had a Woman of the Year award, and I won that award in 1985.
Yes.
But there have been a number of others along the way.
What is Dr. Wendy Orr up to these days?
Well, as you say, I work for a bank.
Yes.
And I manage a very eclectic but very interesting portfolio. So there are three areas that report to me: diversity and transformation, corporate social investment, and employee health and wellness.
Wonderful.
Wow.
Keeps you busy. You have a family, Wendy, as well?
I have a 17-year-old son.
Okay. Also an activist, or is he chilling?
He's chilling.
Yeah. Let his mom do the hard work.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic. What's the prognosis for South Africa from people who fought in the struggle and people who are fighting now?
Look, the struggle is obviously not over. And we may have the vote, but we need to fight for true democracy in terms of providing people with the socioeconomic circumstances that they need in order to succeed. What I look to, though, is for the young people, the 24-year-olds now, who are able to take up that baton. And civil society movements were so strong in the 1980s, and it's sad that we don't see the same kind of thing now. So that really is my challenge to South Africa and to young South Africans. Don't expect the government to deliver, or, you know, someone to do it for you. You need to get out and do it for yourself.
Absolutely. Good. To you, Egan, as well, many thanks for being here. I know it's a bit of a sacrifice to leave your office and the fees that you could have earned, but maybe we'll get you lots of clients as a result of this.
No, thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, you're a champion of the cause. Marvelous. Love having people like you in the studio.
Thank you.
Makes life worth living, doesn't it? To you and Melissa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Also, we have a young lady today. She's a Blue Bulls supporter. And come forward quickly, and you can tell us what you're doing here. You heard about the show. You said you also want to come in. So if I knew how beautiful you were, I would have invited you earlier. Okay, you enjoyed this one?
It was incredible. I just want to say to all the guests, I loved listening to all your stories. I myself am obsessed with human experience, more so human excellence, and I think you all exhibit that in your own way.
Lovely. What's your name?
It's Bronwyn.
And you with the Blue Bulls, aren't you?
I am indeed, yes. I work there part-time. Yeah. I'm a cub, actually. I'm fresh out of varsity, so I was lucky enough to get an internship there.
Excellent. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for
having
me.
Show.
I really did.
We don't invite people in here. We make them listen to our podcast, but you got lucky today. Good.
But thank you so much.
Thank you. Lionel, But I nearly put your line in my
Please. I'm a cocktail. No, thank you so very much. But more importantly, thanks to the guests for coming today to share your experiences and just to enlighten us as a society, and also just to remind us of the history, the richness of our history, and how that has transformed. For everything that you are doing, we just want to say from the bottom of my heart and the nation's heart, please keep on shining the beacon of hope. Keep on doing the work that you are doing. It's very marvelous. Thank you. I'm really rendered speechless.
No, lovely, lovely. We have a message here from Darren from PE. Darren from PE. He says, great show today, Gary, as always. Thanks to you and your team for what you guys do and the topics you manage to talk about. Very nice, Darren.
Thank you, Darren.
Yeah, and keep away from St. Albans. Don't land up there, whatever you do. Thank you, Darren. Thank you all, Duncan as well. Did I thank you, Duncan? We have a new researcher. His name is Benji Scheinberg. Thank you to you, Benji. And yeah, standing up for what is fair against the unfair is what our guests have done. Mm. We appreciate all of that. So on that note, thanks for listening. And until next Tuesday at 12, I'm Gary Hertzberg.
Law, like you've never heard it before. The Laws of Life with Gary Hertzberg on cliffcentral.com.